Hey everyone, it's Dan Smith, host of Coffee in Space. I need to apologize to longtime listeners for how my audio file didn't go through correctly if you downloaded this episode earlier in the week. I'm sorry for that. I have fixed it now and we're ready to go. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to another episode of Coffee in Space, where we have conversations with speculative fiction authors about their characters and the journeys they take. I'm Dan Smith, and I'm glad you're here. Today I have Lavanya Lakshminarayan on the show to talk about her cyberpunk-infused novel, The 10% Thief. Lavanya is a game designer as well as being an author, and honestly, I learned so much about her and her native India in this episode that I think you'll really enjoy the ride. Here's Lavanya Lakshminarayan. Lavanya Lakshminarayan, thank you for joining me today on the show. It's been great to have you. Thanks for having Coffee in Space with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It is absolutely lovely to be here.
And I'm just going to ask you point blank, how did I do on the pronunciation of your name?
Fantastic. That is
okay, good.
Yep.
Excellent. I practiced it literally 10 minutes ago just to make sure I had a chance of getting it right again. So, and for those authors who are listening to this and aspiring authors, you will do a host a whole ton of good by sending a pronunciation guide. Lavanya did that for me, and it honestly saved this interview. So thank you for doing it. And I highly recommend everyone, if you have a name that's a little tricky for people to pronounce, especially if it's not someone from your culture, a nice little pronunciation guide helps. So Lavanya, thank you again for doing that. And of course, thanks for being here today. We're going to talk about The 10% Thief, which is your novel from Rebellion. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about some other things. One, kind of about you as an author, but also some of the things that kind of differentiate our cultures, hopefully as a kind of information exchange so that we can learn more about Indian culture. And I know that's a broad statement as well. It's like, you know, those of us in America, you know, coming from one part of the country saying, oh, it's the same culture as another part of the country. That's not true here either. And so I can understand that it's not true in India, but I do hope to learn a lot from you today. But before we get too far into this thing, I've got my cup of coffee. It is like 8:45 or so PM for you. So I assume you're not drinking coffee at this time. But how do you drink your coffee when you do so?
You assume correct. Because if I were to drink coffee right now, I'd be up all night, which is never a good thing. I drink coffee the traditional South Indian way. So I actually get my blend of coffee from the same store. My parents got theirs, and they've been getting their coffee from the same place for the last 30 years. You make it in a little coffee filter. So it's like a drip filter. So it's just coffee powder in. You know, some room temperature water, you let it drip, and then you mix it in with milk and sugar. I don't add any cream, and I aerate the milk. I kind of put it in two different tumblers, and it's done by hand, so no fancy machines. And you just, you know, pour them one tumbler into the other, and you get this beautiful, dark, and very nutty coffee flavor.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. I'm going to have to find out how to do that sometime. I confess I drink from a more American style, just put it on the pot and let it go type of thing. Although I've been getting to the AeroPress a lot the last year or so, and that's taught me a lot of things about making my own coffee. But here's our first cultural exchange for the interview. My understanding is that India grows a ton of tea. I did not know that India grew a ton of coffee. Is that my misunderstanding or is it generally true?
I think it is generally true. I think we grow way more tea than coffee. But there are a couple of pockets in India where coffee is way more popular. So if you go to the south of India, you are far likelier to get better coffee than tea. If you walk into a restaurant or somebody's home, chances are they will make way better coffee. But if you are in the north of India, generally you get better tea, from my experience.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Your experience beats mine any day on this particular topic. So I'm glad to learn from you a little bit. I will stash that away for a future trip. So I've never been to India. I've been to a lot of countries and I've never been to India. So hopefully someday I can get over there. Kind of put us on a map. Where in India are you from? I assume kind of in the south. You're talking about the coffee and everything, but give us an idea of, you know, paint a mental picture of where in India you're from.
I am from the south. And I'm a little bit of everything in the south. I'm from a part of India traditionally called, I mean, my roots are in Tamil Nadu, but I grew up in Bangalore, which is now the Silicon Valley of India, at least that's what it's called, where it's the IT hub. There are a ton of tech startups all over the place. And that's kind of the south of India. The capital of India is up in the north, and that's Delhi. But I'm probably about over 1,000 kilometers away, I think, in Bangalore. Mm. So it's like across the length of India, pretty much.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, thanks for setting that stage. So is you're the second, I think second, Indian author I've had on the show. I've had a couple others with Indian descent, but you're the first, or you're the second Indian author based in India. So I'm kind of learning that, and the other author was also kind of a cyberpunk writer. Is that something that's popular in your area because of the IT community and the kind of Silicon Valley thing, or is all of India enjoying the cyberpunk that we enjoy here?
I can't speak to broader India, but I definitely know that where I'm from, like nerd culture and geek culture is huge there. You know, everybody's following the entire Marvel universe. Comic books are huge. People are reading science fiction and fantasy a lot. It's still probably smaller compared to the way it's read in the United States or the UK. But the biggest concentration of cyberpunk and sci-fi readers is from the part of India I'm from.
Wow. Is it becoming more popular, less popular, and why is it becoming either way of that?
I think it's skewing towards being more popular. There are a whole bunch of things that have opened it up. So when I grew up in India, we grew up on... If we were reading science fiction and fantasy, and this is, you know, the early 2000s, we were reading Asimov and Philip K. Dick, and it was as if very little had happened since then. But in the later half of that decade, you know, we suddenly had access to Neal Stephenson and William Gibson, and there was all of this stuff flooding in. But most of it was still in the form of books with the occasional movie you would go to a theater to see. But now everybody's got Netflix. And
okay.
So you've just got access to this whole world of science fiction thinking and programming. And so I think it makes you more open to exploring those spaces.
Yeah, so it's almost like, so we've had this long drawn out process. Like we had, and I talk about this all the time, as far as apocalyptic fiction goes, like we had a period where it's all atomic, nuclear war, apocalypse, then it moved into, well, there was a lot of religious apocalypse writing in America there for a long time. And then there's, we're kind of moving into more of a climate change apocalypse. And then of course the dystopias that come off of all of those. We've also been, you know, a smattering of robots and aliens and some good old sci-fi things, but we've had this long time period from the robots from and Asimov to Terminator to, C. Robert Cargill's Day Zero that we've got now. It seems like that's truncated for you in India, that maybe you saw what took 50, 60 years happen in just a couple of decades. In your dealings with those of us from a more Western culture, your book's coming out in England and America. In your dealings with quote-unquote us, are there differences in how we see science fiction versus how you see it? Maybe because of that timeline truncation, truncated timeline, or is it not noticeable?
I think probably the biggest difference is, you know, that sense of history that you have. You're describing this chronology of genre. We don't have that notion at all. So, you know, it was sort of like growing up in the 2000s, you would read Arthur C. Clarke one day, and you would have access to, I don't know, like La Vita or the next, right? So there's this mm-hmm. huge mix of timelines and ideas. I also think in India, by and large, we don't have such strong genre conventions, simply because the way we had access to books was not necessarily stratified. So you would walk into a bookstore and there would be all of these books from, you know, fantasy and slipstream and magical realism and science fiction. And all of it was just imaginative writing that you'd pick up and consume without, like when I go to Barnes & Noble or any indie bookstores in the United States, you know, you have very specific genres on all the shelves. Yeah. We don't have that here. Yeah.
That, I almost think that would be better. And I know for marketing, you kind of got to split out what's what, but I, you know, there's a certain benefit to just enjoying speculative fiction, whatever form it comes in. And I think that's interesting, if not beneficial even. So that's really cool. Well, thanks for, you know, kind of explaining all that to me. I'm fascinated by all of this. So as I mentioned, you're the second author I've had on from India. Cyberpunk, we just talked about its growing relevancy. What is the relevance, since most of my listeners are in the US and then UK is my second largest audience, what is the relevance of Indian-specific cyberpunk to the wider world or even just the Western world?
I think, you know, there's this frequent debate about cyberpunk, right? Is it dead or alive? Like every once in a while, there's this entire raging thing happening on the internet. And I feel like cyberpunk is incredibly relevant today. Just looking at the kind of irresponsible billionaire tech bros and the types of influence they wield on these huge technology platforms that we all belong to that should feel democratic and just aren't. I think cyberpunk is more relevant than even before. And specifically in India, you know, India's, like we said, right, the chronology is very skewed in India. We started our IT boom and the notion of startups and everything at the end of the 90s. So I believe the concerns that are expressed by Indian cyberpunk are set in that time frame. You know, a lot of writers writing it have actually witnessed firsthand the cultural shifts that have come from the before and the after of massive big technology operations, you know, and people accessing your data and the types of changes it brings to your lifestyle, your dependence on technology, and who gets to access technology and who doesn't. I believe it's very, very apparent in India, that sort of disparity, because we have a population with very heavy socioeconomic disparity. I mean, I think less than 5% of the population occupies positions of privilege, and most people do not. And it's immediately apparent when you sit in your bubble of privilege that you are accessing the types of technology that people who don't have that privilege cannot. Simple things that we can take for granted, like accessing school systems online, or being educated online, which really came to the fore during the pandemic. So many people couldn't do that just because they didn't have smartphones. Or if they had smartphones, they didn't have Wi-Fi. And it's really hard to do that using data. And I think places like India, where the disparity is so stark, really give you an opportunity to see how bad things can get when you have this sort of top-down technology whose primary motive is capitalism, right? Like, these are big tech companies who are all out to make profits out of their technology. You can see how bad it can get. And I also think it's the space where there might be more hope, because if technology were to get more open source, how could it help communities at a more local level address their primary needs? To me, cyberpunk is a bit of a warning. It's set in worlds where things could go really, really wrong. And there are people who see how wrong they're going and want to fix them. And that's where I think, you know, cyberpunk from this part of the world can really sort of bring that to the fore, that entire argument.
Yeah. It's almost, I like the warning thing that you mentioned. It's almost like the realization that our fictional science fiction worlds, especially in the cyberpunk, can showcase technology that grows too quickly in the wrong hands, who then choose to use it to manipulate. And you know, we see it in several examples, but I think adding in the understanding, a true understanding of the disparities between the class structure, between levels of the class structure in either country, yours or mine. But I like how you've pointed it out based on yours. I think the relevance is right there, is that, you know, we also struggle with that. It's a little bit different. Just about, I think everybody in America probably has a cell phone and some access to the internet, even in poorer communities. But that doesn't mean that the economics work out quite right. And so I think, and it doesn't mean that there aren't people trying to take advantage of those who do barely have access to technology. And so I think that's really interesting. And we're going to kind of, this is where we're going to kind of blend the away from you as the author and more into the story of your book a little bit. But I think it's interesting. India has a 1,000-year-old culture based on this caste system. Of course, America is very young, and we feel that youth when we start talking like we know what we're doing. And the rest of the world, India, China, places like that, are like, you know, sit down, young fella. But it does seem like pretty much no matter where you're at, people with means want to make sure they stay with means. And if that means keeping other people out, then that's just how it's going to work. And I think that's a good way that cyberpunk, regardless of the culture it came out of, India, America, Europe, wherever, it can teach us that lesson. And thanks for explaining that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up, because I really do see a lot of parallels. I mean, look, there are people with privilege and people without privilege. It's just that the lines might be drawn differently depending on which part of the world you occupy. But I genuinely believe that a genre like cyberpunk can point out that these divisions exist and that we need to work towards making them better and fixing them.
Yeah. And so, like, all right, now I'm doing everything I can not to just jump into your story, because I really want to flesh this out a little bit. But, you know, in my experience, I grew up on a farm. I grew up not wealthy. Plenty of people in town had more in town. So we even have that context there, you know, the people in town versus the people out of town, in the sticks. You know, I definitely didn't grow up with means. I had to join the Navy to get a good career. For me, at least, not saying there aren't careers in small towns, but or rural communities, but I had to join the Navy to get mine, and in doing so, I had to join the Navy to get my access to means, if you will, and that access has brought me to, I think, you know, when I did my taxes this year, it put me in a middle, upper, middle class. So even in the, you know, upper class, middle class, lower class, poverty, we have, you know, various specifications even in there. And I think Indian culture does too. So I've risen from probably standard or lower middle class to probably upper middle class now, according to what my income is and my housing and all that kind of stuff, my access to various things. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to suddenly have access to the top either. And so I think that's another thing that our science fiction in general can tell us, and probably even cyberpunk specifically, is that people will allow you to get to a certain level and then probably not too much further. And some of that's cultural. I don't have the desire. I mean, I have a desire. I wish I was rich, but I don't have the ambition to go do certain things to get there. Does that make sense? And I think it shows that there is probably an upper stop point for a lot of people, even like myself. And science fiction can show us what that upper level looks like for individuals and how other people may try and keep that upper level a little lower. And so anyway, these discussions are super interesting to me. And so thanks for kind of diverging with me down that path. I appreciate it. Okay. So according to the BBC, I'll link to this in the show notes. I was doing some research on caste systems and class in general. And the BBC had a great article about the Indian caste system. The system bestowed many privileges on the upper castes, priests, warrior classes, community leadership classes, while sanctioning repression of the lower castes by privileged groups. So those who had definitely made sure that those who didn't have stayed where they were, and that they knew, and more than that, not just stayed where they were, but knew that that's where they were. And I think there's a lot of that, but I think the caste system from at least ancient India shows how bad that can be. And I like that in your story, you kind of show that with a modern twist, or I'm sorry, postmodern even twist, a futuristic twist of what that could look like. Because Apex City, now turning to your book specifically, Apex City is built for the elite. Can you explain Apex City a little bit?
So Apex City, like you said, it is built for the elite. It is built to encourage the pursuit of elitism. It is sort of a new age solution to all the historic disparities that we've been talking about. Historic in the context of the book, that is, which is, you know, your existing economic privilege, your existing caste system, the way it has been for thousands of years in India, your gender disparities. It is built on the myth that you will earn your way to being the elite through a system of merit. And so it's this futuristic version of Bangalore. There is an electric shield striking through the center. And on one half of the city is where the virtuals live. And these are the people who have limitless privilege in my world. They have, quote unquote, earned their way to the top. And they will do anything to stay on the top of the pecking order, because to fail and to be downgraded is to be deported to the other side of the electric shield, where, you know, there are sandstorms. It's like a dusty tent city. You don't have access to electricity or running water. And you are downgraded and labeled an analog. So Apex City is a very cutthroat city. It reflects a lot of the sort of cutthroatness that you tend to see, you know, like you said, Dan, when people in privilege want to stay in privilege and they come up with various justifications as to why they deserve to and why other people do not deserve to be there. And the justifications people use in Apex City, you know, include how productive somebody is. And this immediately marginalizes, you know, people who are disabled, people who have mental health problems, people who are just having a bad day, as we all do. That is unforgivable. Another marker for them is social persona. So there's this thought policing, right? There are acceptable opinions and there aren't. And the minute you start sort of expressing opinions that aren't, I guess, what the rest of the world thinks, you know, you start being downgraded. And so it's one of those cities where it encourages the existence of a hive mind and a singular set of values, and it makes all of those competitive. So you've got to be the most productive, and you've got to be the most conformist to really thrive there.
So is it a hive mind, a collective conscious that's deciding what those values are? Or in your world, is there an elite that is deciding what they want the conscious to be?
There's an elite feeding a whole bunch of algorithms that kind of determine, you know, so it's a highly it's like a surveillance state where everything you say or do is tracked. You know, the way right now, all our data on our smartphones, you know, a billion companies have access to them. It's an extrapolation of that, where every text you send, every video you watch, every movie, every song you listen to, it sort of mapped against, okay, so, you know, Lavanya is listening to all of this, but the algorithm determines that there's a whole bunch of other stuff that's more important or more relevant or suits the collective, I guess, culture of the city better. So, you know, if she's off listening to punk rock or something, like, we need to get her out of here.
Wow. I want to so badly say, well, that can't happen in real life. But I actually think that it probably could. I think it would start as a societal thing, but I think we could get to a place where people, I mean, almost a 1984 type of situation where somebody or a group of somebodies is deciding what is okay for society and what isn't. I mean, people already have that. They just do it by frowning at someone across the room if they wear the wrong thing to a cocktail party. But like, it could get put on steroids under the wrong circumstances. And we already know that these, you know, I'm on social media too. Everybody's on social media of some kind, probably, I think most people. We already know, we've had it proven that these companies dictate what gets put out and what shows up in our feed and everything. And so you just extrapolate that far enough out and we've got Apex City, right?
Pretty much. And I would love to see it not come true. You know, I'm hoping for a world where this stays strictly in the realms of fiction.
Yeah, it could become alternate history by the time we get there, hopefully. But we'll see, I guess. Okay, so this is, folks, we didn't talk about this before the interview. I'm surprising Lavanya with this, and so sorry, first of all. But so I don't know if you've seen this in the news, because I know you've been traveling and promoting your book a lot lately, but Seattle, the city of Seattle, the city council just passed a resolution adding caste discrimination to its list of illegal discriminations. So sex, gender, age, all these things, race, of course. And they've added caste to it. And I thought, even if you don't want to go too deep into it, first of all, are you aware of it?
I did not that hear did about okay. this happening, and I'm really glad it did. It's important.
Yeah, so I'd just like your thoughts. I'm not holding you to them. I'm not going to quote you or anything, but like, just for those of us listening, or for those of us, my audience, who maybe are like, well, who cares, you know, that Seattle did this, or why did they do it? Because, again, no one cares. It'd be really nice to hear from your cultural perspective why that should matter to us, and what Seattle doing that kind of paves the way for people of Indian descent.
So in India, to quickly go into these sort of axes of privilege and discrimination, one aspect of it is, of course, class, which I think happens all over the world. There's gender and sex. And then you've got the caste system, which is thousands of years old. And these are discriminations that have been built into society, where routinely people who are not from the upper caste. So there's a distinct set of people who are upper caste and those who are lower caste. And historically, you know, like you quoted the BBC article that you were reading the other day, right? The lower caste has been marginalized and also made to feel that they are inferior repeatedly through a number of actions, through the types of jobs they've been eligible for historically, to the kind of access to education they've had, to the types of, I think, general access even to public spaces, whether they're religious places or just recreational places. The discrimination in India has been terrible, and it still exists. And, you know, it doesn't exist just in, you know, villages or rural settlements. It exists in cities as well. And it's honestly unacceptable, and it's terrible. And I think, you know, why this is so important to see, you know, the Seattle Council bringing in legislation that makes it illegal, is because it's not just a thing that occurs, this sort of discrimination, when it's not just a thing that bad people do. It is a bias that people carry around in their heads everywhere,
oh,
right?
That's so good. I'm so glad you pointed out, because a lot of people will say, well, yeah, I know he said a racist thing, but he's not a bad guy. Or some, you know, I know that he looked at that woman a certain way, but he's really a good leader.
Yeah.
Like, though, that's almost seems like, I'm really glad you pointed that out. It really does seem like we try and make sure, like, we don't ruin a person over it. And I don't like cancel culture either. I'm not saying do that. But I'm glad that you pointed out that it's not just evil people who use discrimination based on class and caste system. I assume you're going for, like, basically anyone could be found that they're doing it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely anybody could do it. You know, people who are in positions in management, let's say, at a company, they could just carry that bias around and not hire someone from a lower caste, a historically lower caste. And that happens all the time here. I don't see why why people would not do that anywhere else in the world, unless they are made to be conscious of that bias existing within them.
Yeah. So do you think that, let's say there's a manager who's just interviewed someone, I'm just throwing out pronouns here, but let's say he is reading the resume of a person in Seattle, and he's at a place that hires several people of Indian descent. And he sees that that person's from a poor rural community and grew up on a farm. Do you think that he's going to purposely say, I don't want that person on my payroll because he grew up in the poor class? Or is he not even going to realize that he's doing it and he just does it?
I think it could go either way, honestly. So in India, one of the big things about basing the whole system that governs Apex City on meritocracy is because the notion of merit is an argument that the privileged use in India a whole lot to kind of say, well, you know what? If these people who have historically been marginalized for thousands of years and always been told they're not worth it, if they wanted it hard enough, they would work for it and they would get the same opportunities that everybody else does. And the truth is, they've been told they do not deserve that ever since, you know, recorded history, right? They've consistently been denied those privileges. And so even in India, it could either just be that somebody reads that name and thinks, nope, you know, like wrong caste. Or they could just internally, you know, if they were looking at two candidates' resumes and one was upper caste and one was lower caste, just internally, they could just be like, oh, I like the look of this person more, even if they had the exact same qualifications. It's the same with any kind of bias on the basis of gender or race or, you know, what have you.
Yeah, I can tell you, I don't know that I see it every day, but I'm telling you that happens. That happens. There's no way, especially the one, what do they look right? There's no way that's not happening.
Yeah.
So, and I think also, where you're from type of thing, because we do that here too, you know? Okay. So listeners, I know you're probably like, hey, I come here to learn about a fiction book, not get a cultural identity dissertation. But that's what we do here at Coffee and Space. So we take the 30,000 foot look at things too, but we also drill down a little bit. You know that by now. And that's what I like doing here. And so I'm just grateful, Lavanya, that you kind of just helped me walk through that. I appreciate it a lot. So I'm going to move now to read the synopsis of The 10% Thief. And really you're going to be like, well, I thought you were already talking about that, because so much of this stuff does kind of bleed out, but let me just read it here. Welcome to Apex City, formerly Bangalore. Here, technology is the key to survival. Productivity is power, and even the self must be engineered, for the only noble goal in life, success. Everything is decided by a mathematically perfect bell curve. With the right image, values, and opinions, you can ascend to the glittery heights of the 10%, the virtual elite, and have the world at your feet. The less fortunate struggle among the workaday 70% or fall to the precarious 20%. And below that lies deportation to the ranks of the analogs that you mentioned earlier. With no access to electricity, running water, or even humanity, the system has no flaws and cannot be questioned until a single daring theft sets events in motion that will change the city forever. So that's that is the synopsis that's readily available. That's what is selling people on the book. I think it's a very well-written synopsis. I don't know if you did that or if the publisher, but it's good. What, and I know if I understand it completely correctly, there are several stories that tie your overall theme together here. So what is something that your characters, as they deal with this situation, what is something your characters have taught you through the story?
So it is a bunch of different characters and perspectives coming together to form this sort of mosaic. So I'm talking about maybe 20 different characters all at once. I think the biggest thing I have learned from them is empathy, because walking a mile in each of their shoes, you know, every single character is kind of different. They've all got their unique perspectives on the world. Some of them are not particularly nice ones. Their perspectives I don't agree with. But I wanted to write them anyway to show how this world is structured and how even within the elite, there are people really struggling to belong to the elite, not in a forgivable way, but that is their journey. And, you know, that is what their struggle is. I don't necessarily feel a lot of sympathy for what they're going through because, you know, they are oppressing a bunch of people to do it. But I did, you know, need to get into their heads. And that was a very interesting experience for me.
So, you know, the follow-up question to that is, what did you learn about yourself as you did that? And I think that's even more poignant as you mentioned the characters that you didn't particularly care for, even as you wrote them. What is something that you learned about yourself having to do that?
Ooh, it was tremendously challenging. You know, so I think I actually learned how to push myself out of my comfort zone quite a lot to have to do that. I mean, some of these characters are really cutthroat. If I met them on the street, we would not be friends. And I just had to, you know, I had to decenter myself a lot writing this book because I wanted to talk about all these different types of experiences, some of which were very uncomfortable to me. And in doing so, I had to kind of remove, this is my opinion, and these people are terrible. Not because I still don't feel that way, but because I wanted the reader to be able to objectively come to that conclusion, you know, so to kind of present this person in their own, stuck in their own heads, in their own highly selfish, sometimes personal struggles, and have the reader walk away making their own judgment without me impressing it upon them. And so I had to kind of, you know, teach myself to step away from my own feelings about things while writing these.
That's powerful. Creating that psychic distance, I guess, between you and the character so that you could tell their story. I appreciate that. And I also appreciate authors. It's a tight line. People don't realize how tight a line that is, to where you're not just telling the reader what they should think about this. You're kind of showing it and you're letting the reader walk that path and decide how they feel. So this is a different way of asking, are you a pantser or a plotter? Or are you a planner or I don't remember what the other one is, but, did your characters help you write the story, kind of in a discovery type format? If so, did they surprise you or did you know what they were doing the entire time?
So some of them definitely surprised me. I had intentions going into each of these characters' heads and figuring out what they were about. And some of the time they would just refuse to do what I wanted them to, you know, like I had this all written out and I thought I would build them a particular way and they would just show up on the page while I was typing and say their own thing, you know, stuff I hadn't even thought they would be saying. And a lot of characters changed the way the story took shape. I think I had a kind of, I am a plotter, so I did have my outline. And that kind of went all over the place once the characters started thinking for themselves.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I'm not a plotter. I've tried before and I don't do very well with it. But hearing someone such as yourself who works off of a plot say, sometimes you got surprised as well, that helps me a lot. And it's a really neat way to kind of go through that. Lavanya Lakshminarayan, I am so grateful for this talk. And I hate that I have to like pause and pronounce your name. I'll get better over time. But I am really grateful for our talk. Thanks for coming on Coffee and Space today.
Thank you so much. And you're pronouncing my name just great. So thank you for that.
It just takes me like I have to stop and think about it before I do it. Okay. So for those who want to learn more about you and get to know your work better, how can they get a hold of you?
You can find me on Twitter and on Instagram. I am at lavanya.ln on Instagram and at lavanya_ln on Twitter.
And I'll link to both of those. So that, just go to the show notes, folks, so you can get that. Hey, folks, thanks for listening to this. We really delved into culture because I think culture is important and interesting. And then we got to see kind of how cyberpunk plays its role throughout this process. I want you to go out and get this book, The 10% Thief. I think it's interesting. It's gonna surprise you. It's going to make you think a little bit and see the wider world culture while you're doing it. So check out Lavanya's work and check out her social media venues so that you can keep up with her process. What's next for you? Are you working the next thing already?
I am. I am working on the next book. I'm almost done with it, in fact, thankfully. And it's such a relief to kind of get past the halfway mark, honestly. And it's about the future of food. And it is also going to be out with Rebellion Solaris. I don't have a date yet, but I will keep you posted.
Yeah, and a standing invitation to come back and talk about it when it gets closer.
Oh, thank you so much. I would love to.
Awesome. Okay, hey folks, thanks for listening in. Share this with someone you know who loves discussions on culture and class. Make sure they get a chance to hear this episode as well. And I will see you next week as we meet with another author over a cup of coffee in space.